Hello and welcome to Volume 26 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll talk to three guests who will enlighten us on forest policy issues. We'll have a conversation with three other guests about the animals that inhabit the forest, namely beavers, quail, and non-game birds, and we'll check into the current trends in the stumpage market while introducing a forest finance calculator that you can really use. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Our first guest is Mitch Dubinsky with the American Forest and Paper Association. Welcome back, Mitch.
Hey, it's good to be here.
You've been watching the developments in the reauthorization of the Clean Water Act. What's new in this area?
Well, actually, Hayes, it sort of reminds me of the old Yogi Berra line. It's deja vu all over again related to wetlands and water quality. Mm-hmm. And just recently, the EPA came out with a notice talking about what is considered to be a water of the United States, which is real important to forest landowners because of the fact that there are a lot of wetlands in the south, and a lot of landowners would see that some of their property could be either included within this new definition or proposed definition, or might even be excluded from the new definition. So it's real important in terms of the value of their property and what they can and can't do on their land.
So the key phrase to keep in mind is what is waters of the U.S. What brought about a re-examination of that point?
Well, that's a good question. There was a decision back a few months ago in a Supreme Court decision, actually, that decided that non-navigable isolated wetlands that are located within a state are not subject to the Clean Water Act just by the sole use by migratory birds. So again, that's very important. The Supreme Court said that the Congress had no intention of regulating waters that are isolated, that are not navigable, and within a state. And the only basis for regulation was for migratory birds and their migration patterns. So it's real critical for forest landowners to know sort of where their lands are located in that type of a landscape.
Are there competing views about what the Clean Water Act should entail? I suppose one group would see it more narrowly defined in terms of navigability, and others might see it as more broadly defined.
Right. You know, not only the public, but the courts have had mixed opinions about what that means. And, you know, some courts have gone as far as saying that, for example, the tributaries of the navigable waters, the tributaries, the streams that feed into navigable waters, should not be considered waters of the United States, while some other courts have said, well, in fact, they are waters of the United States. So how that'll be decided is we'll likely get into, you know, discussions with EPA through their proposed rulemaking. I'm sure Congress will be involved in it. And the ultimate opportunity for forest landowners in Alabama to voice their opinion is to send the note to EPA, get on their website and look it up, and you know, voice their comments as to what they think a water of the United States should be. And I think it's important for them and important for their property rights.
In writing such a letter, you mentioned it should be addressed to EPA. Where is this battle going to be decided? Is it an interagency sort of thing, or does it find itself on the halls of Congress?
Well, right now it's being fought within the halls of the administration, within the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers. But obviously, there's a close look and close scrutiny by members of Congress as to you know, what the intent of Congress was. So I think Congress will be paying close watch. So it might even be worthwhile for the landowner, when they send the letter to EPA, is to CC their congressman just to let the congressman know about this issue and the concerns that they might have.
Mm-hmm. Could you just briefly describe what a forest owner faces when he looks at the Clean Water Act? How does that translate to him on the ground? What should he recognize?
That's a good sort of on-the-ground segue. Landowners need to know what their responsibilities are, and under the Clean Water Act and mostly under state rules and regulations and laws, the idea of protecting water quality is really through the implementation of forestry best management practices, and those best management practices have been adopted by, you know, the Alabama Forestry Commission, and then landowners through their discussions when they go to sell timber and work with either a consulting forester or a logger or a wood dealer or somebody that they're going to sell the stumpage to, they should be aware of implementing best management practices to protect water quality. And the folks in Alabama have done a good job, just as they have done in the South. And reports indicate that forestry is one of the lowest contributors to water quality impairment. So we've done a good job, but it's always important that a landowner be aware of their responsibilities about forestry programs and practices.
Okay, thanks, Mitch.
Sure.
Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
Well, if keeping up to date on the issues that Mitch discussed is difficult for you, you may need some expert help, especially if you find yourself on the wrong end of some kind of environmental enforcement action. Here to introduce a service that provides that assistance is Dan Byfield with the American Land Foundation. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Hayes.
Dan, we asked you here to describe a new concept in helping landowners protect their property rights. What is that?
Well, we started, I'm president of the American Land Foundation, which for over 10 years have been working with landowners across the country trying to protect their property rights. And as your first guest just talked about, one of the issues that always seems to come up are wetlands or endangered species or some sort of federal law that encroaches on somebody's property and their rights or ability to use their land. And so one of the ideas that we had about a year ago was to put together LandGuard, and it is basically a prepaid legal plan for landowners. It costs $12 a month or $144 a year. And with that plan, you have the ability to pick up the phone, call the 800 number, and get a hold of an attorney. And the attorneys that we are contracting with are all experts in the field of property rights. And hopefully what we're doing is giving landowners the ability to stand up and fight either an environmental organization or a federal or state agency that wants to regulate their property.
For that prepaid legal plan, can you give us an idea of how far the people who participate in this plan might be able to go with an issue and kind of when the start and stop point would be?
Well, what we've tried to do is, knowing that nobody likes to, first of all, talk to a lawyer necessarily, the problem is with individuals out on the farm or their ranch, when they discover they have an endangered species or they have a problem with a federal agency or something, they really don't know who to turn to. And so what we have tried to do is create a program where they will have the ability to pick up the phone or go to someone's office and visit with them for as long as it takes. Over the phone, if it takes 2 hours to go through your issue and ask questions and try to solve the situation or understand what your situation is and where you go, then we take that much time and help the individual. If it turns into litigation or it takes a few more phone calls or a few more procedures or steps, the attorney that you are talking to, if you'd like him or her, you can hire them at a 25% reduction in their usual rate. And so we've tried to structure it to where you get your problem solved right up front. You understand what you need to do and how to attack the issue. And if it turns into something further, then we're going to try to get the attorneys to reduce their rates.
Okay, and that program is called LandGuard.
Right.
Thank you, Dan. Rounding out our forest policy panel is John Green with the U.S. Forest Service. Good to have you back, John.
Good morning, Hayes.
John, I understand that you've recently participated in a study about how the estate tax affects forest owners. First, I just wanted to ask you, what questions were on your mind as you began this project?
Hayes, we were looking for characteristics of the forest estates themselves, whether people were involved in having to pay the estate tax, whether they use special valuation on either their land or their timber.
Tell us what that is briefly, special use valuation.
That's a provision in the tax code that permits an executor to appraise assets that are used in farming or in a trade or business, and that's where timber qualifies.
Okay.
According to their value and use rather than their market value.
Mm-hmm. So those were the questions. The were they paying tax? Did they have forest in their estate? And were they taking advantage of the special use valuation? What did you find out?
Well, the name, just a few things. We found out that the proportion of forest estates that owe federal estate tax is many times higher than the U.S. population in general. And we feel like that really points out how important it is for a forest owner to have an estate plan. We found that only about a third of forest estates qualify for special use valuation. And we think that's because the regulations for special use valuation make it hard for forest land to qualify. We also found that in 40% of the cases where an estate tax is due, the heirs had to sell land or timber to pay the tax because there weren't enough other assets available. And this didn't just happen to small holdings. Estates as large as 2,000 acres reported they had to sell timber, and estates as large as 10,000 acres reported they had to sell land.
Well, there have been anecdotal stories like that, but this is really some hard data then that that indicates that the estate tax is actually causing a sale, isn't it?
Right. This is that was one of the objectives of the study, to find out if the anecdotal information was accurate and to get some kind of estimates of how many acres were affected.
Mm-hmm. Of the 40% that had to sell land and timber, did you get an idea of how extensive that sale was in order to cover those taxes?
Well, the people that had to sell land, it was usually just a small part of the estate. It averaged about 400 acres.
Mm-hmm.
But about 30% of the cases, the land wound up being converted to other more developed uses than forest land.
It actually left the forested category and went into another use.
Right.
There's an idea that the estate tax has been eliminated. Is that true?
No, that's not true, Hayes, which you know. The act that's currently law is the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act of 2001, and that will reduce the number of forest estates subject to federal estate tax, but slowly over a number of years. Still, between now and 2005, we estimate that one in five forest estates is still going to owe estate tax because the effective exemption amount for estates is only going to be $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
After 2006, when it goes up to $2 million, we think still one in 10 forest estates
mm-hmm.
is going to owe estate tax. And then in 2009, it's scheduled to go up to $3.5 million. And we think still 1 in 20, maybe as many as 1 in 20 forest estates are going to owe tax. The law eliminates the estate tax in 2010, but along with that comes a restriction in the step-up in basis that heirs receive. And then the way the law is presently written, in 2011, we go back to pre-2001 law, right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's still something people need to keep an eye on.
Right, because right, mm-hmm. it's probably going to change from year to year.
Okay. All right, thanks, John. We appreciate you joining us.
All right, thank you, Hayes.
Well, if you haven't heard, hunting is big business in Alabama. A segment of Alabama's tourism dollar can be traced to hunters who come to Alabama in pursuit of wild game. Here to highlight an innovation aimed at hunters is Ted DeVos with Regions Bank in Montgomery. Welcome, Ted.
Thank you, Hayes.
Ted, I've heard that people come to Alabama to play golf, but I also hear that hunting lodges have picked up on this golf trail idea. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. Through the Wildlife Federation, that came up with an idea about trying to develop a quail trail similar to the concept of the Bass Trail and the Golf Trail. Of course, there's going to be a different way to handle each one of those, but the quail trail concept was developed over a series of years by a bunch of individuals sitting around brainstorming about how we could not only increase some of the recreational dollars income from other states to Alabama, but also keep some of our recreational dollars here, in addition to trying to develop some underlying projects associated with some of that money to use the quail trail as a vehicle to try and develop a wild quail habitat initiative, as well as some other projects associated with quail habitat, quail hunting in the state of Alabama.
Do you have an idea of how many lodges participate in this trail?
Right now, the thing just got up and running on the website, and it's running about 15, if I remember right, lodges, commercial hunting lodges that have developed underneath this thing.
Mm-hmm. And how are they distributed around in the state?
There's generally a concentration in the central and east central part of the state, but we have pretty much a commercial lodge available to, you know, anybody in the state of Alabama within probably 50 or 100 miles or so. You know, they're scattered fairly well through, but there is a concentration in central and east central Alabama.
Okay. And what do you know about the cost of these opportunities?
Well, they vary between lodges. Depends on the quality. There's a lot of different ways, you know, from a commercial hunting operation, there's a lot of different ways that these quail hunting opportunities are available to hunters. You can, you know, run a preseason release operation. Obviously, you can have wild quail.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be high dollar,
mm-hmm.
extremely high dollar, and out of the reach of most folks. You can also obviously have pen-raised quail put out, and you can have those put out on a preseason operation in September or October, and they're hunted throughout the season, and they mimic wild quail hunting pretty much. Those are going to be next in line as far as dollars, and then you have the day of the release operations that they put quail out that day and put the hunters out on the ground. Most lodges are going to operate under that premise just because of the constraints of being able to have that many birds on the ground hunted throughout the season. Most folks have to rely on day of the release operations, and most of those are pretty high quality. And we'll run, and you know, it'll be a couple hundred dollars a day for quail hunting under that form.
All right, that'll be known as the Alabama Quail Trail. Thanks for joining us, Ted.
You're welcome.
Just as Ted highlighted the interest associated with quail, our next guest can highlight the interest associated with other birds, non-game species. Debbie Wilson is with us. Hello, Debbie.
Good morning.
Debbie, you're with the Florence Lauderdale Tourism Office.
Right, we're in North Alabama.
In North Alabama, okay. Just tell us a little bit about these people that call themselves birders.
Well, the average bird watcher now tends to be fairly young and moderately affluent and very committed to preserving wildlife and its habitat, and they're very desirable for the tourism industry because they're so enthusiastic and it doesn't take a lot of equipment to be a birder, and that's one reason that the numbers are rising. The latest study was in 1995, and 54.1 million Americans call themselves birders, which really almost equals the nation's 57 million fishermen, which, of course, we're in the big market with fishing as well, and it's far more than the 29 million golfers, and it also fits in with a lot of the other trails, like he was talking about the Quail Trail and the Robert Trent Jones Golf Trail, and now we're going to have a birding trail.
Well, tell us about that trail.
They started in, we modeled the hours after Texas and South Alabama, and it's a coalition of the tourism offices and chambers in North Alabama going together with the state and U.S. federal government to create a trail for birders, and that will mostly be signage and promotional materials where birders will be able to go on in different areas, and we list those where the best bird watching would occur.
Okay, and where generally in the state would this trail be located?
Our portion would be in North Alabama. There's already one on the Coastal Birding Trail, which is very successful.
Mm-hmm.
But this one would be in North Alabama, roughly Decatur, Huntsville, Florence, East Alabama, over to our area west.
Okay. What is the tourism agencies, what have they done to alert the public that might have an interest in this type birding?
Well, we're just getting to that point now that we've got the funding committed with the match money, and we'll be presenting a brochure and also a bunch of we'll be alerting the public that way, and there's also been a lot of publicity on it already.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. And the signage, I'm sure, would help along the roadways to keep people on track.
Yes, and also it will be at the different locations. And, of course, with different groups, we do want to let them know because I understand from your group and others there may be some interest in the private sector as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly helps so. Well, thank you, Debbie. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
Jim Armstrong is our next guest. Hello, Jim.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. Jim's with the Auburn University School of Forestry. Jim, we asked you here to talk about beavers. Those are critters that can cause a lot of timber damage. What's the status of the beaver population now?
The beaver population in Alabama, as most forest owners probably realize, is very healthy. A lot of people are surprised to know that beaver have staged a very successful comeback around the turn of the century, beaver populations were just about eliminated from most of the United States through some very good wildlife management practices, habitat protection, restocking. We were able to bring beaver populations back. And, of course, at that time, that seemed like a very positive thing because beaver pelts or their fur were a very valuable commodity. So what was not anticipated was the bottom falling out of the fur market. Consequently, very few people trap beaver. Their ranges or their available habitat has increased. And populations have now grown to the point that they are a nuisance in many areas.
Mm-hmm. So it's gone from a standpoint of encouraging the beaver population. Now we've done such a good job that they're considered pests in some areas.
Right. And, of course, it's kind of a love-hate relationship because beaver swamps and beaver ponds are some of the most valuable wildlife habitat we have. And the return of the wood duck population is directly linked to the recovery of the beaver population. However, of course, beaver often get into areas where they're not really appreciated, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, then it becomes necessary to do something to try to control those populations.
If they're in an area where they're not desired, how do you control a beaver?
Well, the best techniques really involves removing the beaver population from the area, which is going to involve some kind of trapping, probably lethal trapping with a Conibear 330 type of body gripping trap. We get calls a lot of times from people that have beaver problems, and they say, well, we don't want the beaver hurt. Well, unfortunately, beaver populations have reached the point that most people don't want you releasing live beaver on their property.
Mm-hmm.
So lethal trapping tends to be the best technique. A lot of people come up with the theory of tearing out the dam,
mm-hmm.
and that will work in some instances, but if the beaver are still in the area, they're going to very quickly repair that dam. So generally, the best technique is to try to reduce the population as much as possible before removing the dam. There are techniques where people can have the benefits of a beaver pond on their area without having all the problems associated with beaver girdling trees and flooding more acreage through techniques such as the Clemson beaver pond leveler that allows a person to control the water level while at the same time keeping the beaver out of the area.
So that's controlling the dam itself without necessarily removing all the beavers, is that right?
Right. Or even all the beaver can be removed, but the dam can still be intact. It essentially would be a standpipe just like you would have in a pond. It would allow you to maintain the water level at a desirable level where you could have the wood duck populations without having the extra flooded habitat.
Okay. All right. I see. Well, we've got a link to some beaver control experts by your image on the website. So we do appreciate your joining us, Jim.
Glad to do it, and good luck.
All right. Well, forest owners increasingly want to understand the financial return of owning forest land, and there are many financial calculators out there that are useful, but the best one that we've seen that's been designed for use on the Internet was designed by our next guest, Dr. Wee-Wan Shu of the Texas Forest Service. Welcome, Dr. Shu.
Thank you.
Tell us about this financial calculator that you've developed for use on the Internet.
Yes, I have a set of financial calculators and simulators on the web, which I collectively call the Timberland Decision Support System. It's basically a set of tools for helping forest landowners to make better timberland investment and management decisions. The main feature of the system is a timberland management simulator. It allows you to type in some very basic information about your forest land in the simulator. When you run the simulator, it will tell you how much timber you can get and how much money you can make off your land for a given management scenario. The information needed to run a simulation include trees per acre, stand age, site index, management costs, timber prices, and the management actions to be taken, such as thinning and final harvest at certain ages with certain intensity. The system also includes a set of basic financial calculators for illustrating basic concepts for timberland investment, such as the present value, future value, inflation, and interest rate. The third item in the system, the Timberland Investment Calculator, is for calculating the returns on your investment given the cost and revenue information of your timberland investment. This calculator can do most of the things that the basic calculators do and much more.
And it's something that one can access right off the Internet.
Yes.
Could you profile a kind of a typical user of the system?
Yes. This system, as you said, is web-based, therefore it's freely accessible to everyone. However, it was its intended users of the system are ordinary forest land owners. For the convenience of the forest land owners, the software was written using a scripting language so that no software installation is needed. Whoever has access to a browser can use it immediately. Also, each calculator and simulator on the site is accompanied by a tutorial of the concepts involved, and the calculators are fairly simple and straightforward. To make the Timberland Management Simulator easy to use, I set all the required inputs of the simulator on one long page so that one can go through the page from top to the bottom and doesn't worry about missing anything before clicking the submit button. You don't have any menu to put down like in a desktop software environment. And I also keep the input and output of the simulator simple.
Okay. How would you recommend someone use this if they decide to participate in?
The basic calculators are very simple and easy to use following the instructions and examples accompanied by the calculators. The Timberland Management Simulator and the Timberland Investments Calculator come with a set of default inputs.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good starting point for analysis. The user can simply click the submit button at the bottom of the page to get a set of outputs without making any input or change to the default inputs. The user can then modify the default inputs to fit his or her land management situation using the back button of the browser. It's very easy to do what-if analysis by making small changes to the inputs and see how the results change with it.
Okay, so there's a sort of a hand-holding feature. If you don't know some of the inputs, you can just use the default feature.
That's right. If the user have any problem with a concept or input in the system, usually some explanation is just one click away. And users are always welcome to contact me for any question or comment about a system, and I'll add more useful features to the system in the future.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Hsu.
Thank you.
Occupying the markets chair today is Eddie Carlson, a forestry consultant in Montgomery, Alabama. Welcome, Eddie.
Good morning, Hayes.
Eddie, this program takes place in January, and our calendar has nothing written on it yet. Why don't you fill in the calendar for us and tell us what landowners should be doing?
Okay, Hayes, you know, in forestry, there are things that we do all year long, like timber cruising, timber marking, timber cutting, but there are also seasonal aspects to managing a tract of land or a forest. And right now, today, being in the middle of January, we're in the middle of tree plant season. So if a landowner wants to plant some trees this year, December, January, February are probably the best months to plant trees. So he would need to make sure, he or she would need to make sure that they've got trees ordered and someone to plant them. And then after that, many landowners do herbaceous releases, so that would be coming up in the March, April, May, or more April, May. And so they would need to be go ahead and lining that up as well.
Mm-hmm.
Another seasonal aspect of what we do is prescribed burning and control burns. And it's time now to be, if you haven't already got your fire lanes in, we've had a break in the weather down here. If you've got a dry time in January, go ahead and get your fire lanes plowed, get them ready, so that when you've got that right day in January or February or March, that you can take advantage of it. Also, you want to have your fire lanes plowed as soon as possible just to protect you from any fire, you know, wildfires or fires that are set, got out by accident or mm-hmm. something like this.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if a landowner's thinking, hey, I may want an aerial photograph of my property, now's a good time to do that. This time of year, the leaves are off the hardwood trees, and when you see an aerial photograph, you can delineate the pine and the hardwood areas a lot better when the photograph is taken when the leaves are off. So this is another thing to do right now. And one thing that landowners, when they think about selling timber, so often they wait till it's dry and think, well, now that it's dry, it's a good time to sell timber. And when a landowner decides to sell, that process sometimes can take 3 or 4 months. And so depending on what kind of timber they have and what kind of sale they need to have, the process from, hey, I want to sell timber to where they actually receive money could take 3 or 4 or 5 months. And so now is really the time to be planning, hey, what do I want to sell this year? Am I going to have a unit sale? Am I going to have a lump sum sale? And what do I need to be doing to prepare for that?
We've got about a minute left. Give us a sketch about the timber market in your area.
Okay. Right now is a good time to sell timber, in my opinion. Our markets are good. I think a lot of it is driven by the weather. The rain we've had, the mills have been low, and so the pine pulpwood market has been increasing in price, and one blessing is just they'll take it. So often in the summer times when the mills are full, they have no need for the wood. But right now they're open, and you can readily move pine pulpwood. Pine logs are selling fairly well. The plywood market seems to be stronger than the lumber market. There's a lot of supply right now, lumber-wise, in the U.S., so I think that probably the pine logs are not as strong. By the same token, hardwood logs and hardwood pulpwood are much like pine pulpwood in that they're good right now. I think the wet weather has had an effect on that. The market conditions are better, and we're seeing good prices on hardwood logs as well as hardwood pulpwood.
All right. Thanks, Eddie. Well, that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Mitch Dubinsky, Dan Byfield, John Green, Ted DeVos, Debbie Wilson, and Jim Armstrong, and we're grateful also to Wee-Wan Shu and Eddie Carlson. The hunting opportunities that are so prevalent this time of year are made possible by landowners such as you who provide for millions of people, many of whom travel great distances, a place to hunt game species. Hunters are willing to pay for their own place, resulting in a fatter wallet for the landowner and a palpable increase in rural property values. Some enterprising landowner will find a way to provide a habitat for non-game species, such as songbirds, and make his or her property so attractive to birds that it will also attract a paying customer, an individual or birding club that would like to have their own place to watch or photograph non-game species, a place they can pay for, and consequently set up in the way they think is best for attracting the species they would like to see. Alabama forest owners have such places, about 20 million acres, in fact, ready to be made into that perfect place for practicing the art of birding. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.